From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, top Islamic State leaders killed, use of child soldiers on the rise in the CAR, Russia's economic woes, plus New Yorkers reacting to the Cuba news with elation and skepticism. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. military officials say more than 1,300 airstrikes and a stronger Iraqi security force is having a significant effect on the ability of the Islamic State group to operate in Iraq. VOA's Jeff Seldon reporting from the Pentagon.
U.S. and coalition airstrikes that began in August are leaving a mark on the Islamic State's leadership. According to a senior defense official, in just the last month or so, taking out the group's number two official in Iraq, its military emir in Iraq, and the emir of Mosul. The announcement followed an optimistic assessment by the commander of the Combined Joint Task Force for the operation known as Inherent Resolve.
Daesh has been halted and transitioning to the defense and is attempting to hold what they currently have.
Referring to the Islamic State by its Arabic acronym, U.S. Lieutenant General James Terry says airstrikes clearly have taken a toll.
They're having a hard time in terms of communicating right now, in terms of resupply.
He says that's hurting the Islamic State's ability to push out propaganda, recruit new fighters, and even spread fear.
You can go to the social media and see some of the stuff that's coming out of places like Mosul in relationship to the inability of the self-declared caliphate to govern populations out there.
Not all analysts agree with Terry's assessment. Jane's Intelligence Review concluded last week airstrikes have not caused any significant change in Islamic State operations, nor have they degraded the group's offensive capabilities. But in Sinjar, where coalition air support has been backing Kurdish fighters, there's optimism. With the help of our friends and the alliance, we will evict them from all Iraq, says this Peshmerga colonel. Coalition officials remain cautious, and the challenge remains of bringing more of Iraq's Sunni tribes back into the fight on the side of a government that once alienated them. There are also questions about the Islamic State's hold in Syria, where U.S. plans to find and train a moderate opposition force have yet to get underway. All in all, America's Lieutenant General Terry says the fight has a long way to go.
I still think we're, in terms of building some of the capabilities that are required there, probably about 3 years down the road minimum.
Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
And also in the news, Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday he's confident his country's struggling economy will rebound within 2 years and that the currency will stabilize, but offered no new remedies for the crisis. At a three-hour end-of-the-year news conference, Mr. Putin said central bank and economic officials are making what he called suitable and correct decisions to stabilize the value of the ruble, even as the country's economy heads to a projected recession next year. He predicted better times ahead for Russia, just not immediately, even if world oil prices remain low or fall even more, cutting deeper into revenues for Moscow's key export.
That
Russia's economy will inevitably adapt to the environment of lower energy prices, and then he said inevitably there will be a time when the prices will start rising again with the global economic growth and rising energy demand. Mr. Putin said Russia's currency reserves are sufficient right now to stabilize the country's economy. European Union leaders on Thursday focused on two key problems that have dogged the EU for much of the year, the crisis in Ukraine and the region's struggling economy. Lisa Bryant reports the leaders met as the bloc agreed to new sanctions against Russian-annexed Crimea.
The new EU measures will ban all investment and restrict trade in Crimea, and even ban EU cruise ships from visiting Crimean ports. They are just the latest in a series of punitive measures enacted by Europe and the United States this year over the crisis in Ukraine. Before the meeting, the new EU president, former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, said the summit should send a strong signal of Europe's support for Ukraine, including financial support.
For sure. We will not find a long perspective, long-term solution for Ukraine without adequate and consistent, both tough and responsible strategy towards Russia. for me, it's clear that modern, stable, independent Ukraine will be and must be foundation of this new strategy.
Russia expert Kadri Leek, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations in London, said sanctions are only one element of a larger strategy needed to change the behavior of Russia and of its president, Vladimir Putin.
The chief question still is to take the sanctions tool and craft it into a tool for policy. Because right now, we have sanctions that are working, but we don't really have meaningful strategy behind them.
She says that strategy should not only include ensuring Russia respects the Minsk ceasefire agreement with Ukraine, but deal more broadly with Russia's effort to carve out a sphere of influence at the expense of its neighbors. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
Local residents and officials in northeastern Nigeria say suspected members of the Boko Haram militant group killed 32 people, kidnapped more than 100 others, happened in a raid on the village of Gumsuri. The attack took place Sunday, according to residents who fled to the city of Maiduguri. News of the attack took several days to emerge because the area's mobile phone network was damaged in earlier attacks. A growing number of fighters in Central African Republic's two-year-old civil war are children. It's estimated there may be as many as 10,000 child soldiers, four times more than when the conflict began. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The charity organization Save the Children says both boys and girls are being recruited by former Seleka rebels and anti-Balaka militias. Some of the kids are as young as eight. Veronique Aubert is Senior Conflict and Humanitarian Policy and Research Advisor for Save the Children.
The situation is of great concern to Save the Children. Children are on a daily basis exposed to violence. Many of them have been killed. Many of them have been victims of sexual violence. Many of them have lost their relatives, have seen their house destroyed, or had to flee either within the country or outside the country.
Aubert says many lack access to food, education, and health care.
Some are being abducted and recruited by force, by commanders who come in and take them, very often just to use them to serve in combat zone or to be their slave and sex slave. And others are joining for lack of protection, for lack of security, and for lack of access to education, which is a great concern.
Some children say they joined armed groups due to pressure from parents or peers, or a desire to protect their communities, or to seek revenge for the death of family members. About 2 years ago, mostly Muslim Seleka rebels toppled President Francois Bozize. Their leader, Michel Djedodia, became interim president. But many former rebels turned to banditry and attacked Christian and traditional religion communities. Then, last December, in response to those attacks, anti-Balaka militias formed. They launched revenge attacks against Muslims. Djedodia resigned last January, and an interim government was formed. However, ongoing violence has killed thousands of civilians and displaced hundreds of thousands of others. Aubert says many children are traumatized from witnessing violence or being forced to take part in it.
That's why Save the Children try to respond on the ground with some programs to try to provide some psychological support to some of these children through some community-based programs to try to assist those children or to try to provide them with some education in emergency response program. But so much more is needed.
But before Save the Children can help these kids, the organization must meet with the commanders of each armed group. Some agree to let the children go. Others do not.
There is a need for a more systematic and organized demobilization process. And that's why one of the recommendations of the report is to call on the UN, on the peacekeeping operation, on the government and other partners to make sure that there is a proper demobilization strategy that's been put in place, that the peacekeeping operation has the capacity to reach out to those children to try to demobilize them and reintegrate them.
Some child soldiers are ordered to hold a talisman during attacks. It's believed by group members to have mystical powers that will protect them from harm. Bullets can quickly dispel that myth. Education has been hit hard. Many children have not been to school in 2 years. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
International Organization for Migration reports 2014 is the deadliest year on record for migrants who've been fleeing conflict, political persecution, as well as economic hardship. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Death has always been an unfortunate part of migration. Since 2000, more than 40,000 migrants have died while trying to cross borders around the world. This past year has been particularly bad. The International Organization for Migration reports some 5,000 people have lost their lives fleeing across seas, remote deserts, or mountains. Most of these deaths, two-thirds, have occurred in the Mediterranean. IOM says more than 3,000 people have drowned while crossing the Mediterranean Sea in flimsy smugglers' boats trying to reach Europe. It says most of those risking their lives are Syrians and Palestinians fleeing conflict, and migrants from the Horn of Africa, particularly Eritreans, desperate to escape fighting, oppression, and poverty. Head of the Migration Research Division at IOM, Frank Lasko, tells VOA there are many smugglers who exploit and profit from the misery of others.
There are suggestions that we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here, and there is no shortage at the moment of potential clients for the services of these smugglers, so it's a very lucrative business to be in.
There are no easy solutions to the problem of illegal migration. But IOM says cracking down on smugglers and traffickers through tougher sanctions and convictions might dissuade some from entering the business. It urges governments to decriminalize irregular migrants so they can report smugglers to the police for prosecution. IOM fears the number of deaths at sea could rise now that Italy has discontinued Mare Nostrum, a rescue operation which has saved thousands of lives. Mare Nostrum has been replaced by a European Union operation called Triton, which patrols a much smaller area. The agency says an unprecedented number of man-made crises in the world, including conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Libya, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan, are driving migration. It says other factors, such as the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, climate change, and extreme weather, also are pushing people to seek places of refuge. IOM estimates around 232 million people are international migrants. Lasko says that represents about 3% of the world population.
That 3% figure has remained fairly constant over the last 20, 30 years. So globally, we have not seen a major increase in international migration in recent years. However, in some countries, particularly in Europe, North America, Australia, there have been significant increases in immigration. And within those countries, certain cities absorb or attract more migrants than others.
IOM says migration is inevitable. It also is necessary and desirable, especially now when aging societies are short of labor. The agency says migration, when well managed, can be of great benefit to both the countries of origin and destination. For example, it notes migrants around the world send an estimated $435 billion in remittances to their families back home. This, it says, is three times larger than foreign aid to developing countries. It adds these remittances provide a lifeline for many people in impoverished nations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
U.S. State Department official says a January meeting that had been previously scheduled with Cuban officials in Havana is being expanded and moved to a higher level of diplomacy. Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson announced the change in a Thursday briefing as she shed some light on the process of restoring U.S. relations with Cuba. VOA's Pam Dawkins has the story.
Assistant Secretary Jacobson says she will travel to Havana for the talks, which she expects will take place in late January. She says a meeting that was originally a periodic review of Cuba-U.S. migration will now include talks on restoring diplomatic relations.
That process is relatively straightforward, frankly, from a legal perspective.
She says the first step in the process has already occurred. The U.S. and Cuba have agreed to begin the work on restoring ties.
We can do that via an exchange of letters or of notes. It doesn't require a formal sort of legal treaty or agreement.
She says U.S. diplomats in Cuba would transition from being under Swiss protection.
It requires us also terminating the 53-year agreement that we've had with the Swiss government as our protecting power. And the same for the Cubans.
Also, the U.S. will begin a review of Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism.
We have to review the record of Cuba over the last 6 months and ensure that they have not been participants or supported acts of international terrorism over the last 6 months. We have to look at whether they have renounced the use of terrorism.
Jacobson also addressed the objections to restoring ties with Cuba that have been raised by some members of Congress who have threatened to block funding for an embassy.
The status of our diplomatic relationship in terms of going from not having diplomatic relations to having full diplomatic relations, we believe is entirely constitutionally the president's right and responsibility.
Jacobson, however, added that the issue of funding belongs to Congress and what she described as the power of the purse. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
President Obama's announcement on Wednesday that the United States will restore full diplomatic relations with Cuba and ease monetary and other restrictions on Cuba was met with some optimism and some caution as well in New York City, where many Latin Americans live, including several thousand Cuban Americans. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Thursday was a cold morning in New York City, but Alex, who originally hails from a Central American country not far from Cuba, was feeling warm-hearted when he saw yesterday's news on TV.
What was going on with Cuba before I was born, 50-some years ago, I don't know too much about, but obviously it's a good thing to try to get people together, you know? I mean, again, I saw all those people celebrating, how happy they were. I said, wow, this has to be good, you know? I mean, they're Cuban. If they think it's good, who are we to say no, it's not, you know? As Obama said last night, he said, listen, it hasn't worked. Whatever we've been doing, it hasn't worked. So it's time to try something different. Everybody is going to smoke them Cuban cigars legally. That makes me feel good to see people enjoy themselves.
Catherine was on Fifth Avenue for a mid-morning cigarette break. She resents the Cuban regime in spite of what she sees as its self-interested willingness to liberalize its relations with the U.S.
I do think that it's ridiculous that Cuba doesn't let people come out of their country, not even to vacation in the United States, and also that we're not allowed to go over there. It's a beautiful country, and the people are beautiful, and they risk their lives to come here every single day. I think that this should be allowed to have more freedom in their speech when they want to talk, to the fact that they're not even allowed to use the internet.
What do you think then about the president's move to allow it to become more liberal back and forth?
I think that's great.
Cuba-born Alex Derribes, who came to the United States in 1966 as a boy, takes a skeptical view of Cuban President Raul Castro's intentions.
You know, from the past when he's shown this open forum that he gives, but then he doesn't give up anything. There's always, you know, room for improvement. You always want to try, open up the gates and see what happens.
The Rebus says his family has many decades of mistrust and even hatred to overcome.
Yeah, for what he did, the country, for what he's doing to the country, just the communism. When I was little, going to school, it was, you know, the uniform and singing, you know, communist songs before you start classes, and everything was communism, communism, communism. That's why we came here, because my mom didn't really want us living up like that. So hopefully it'll turn out better, but, you know, we'll see. To start.
New Yorkers always like an opportunity and a bit of pleasure, and that can influence their political views. Pete Tierney exports solar energy equipment.
I mean, I think it's time, you know, Fidel's long gone. I think it's time, and I would love to see if we could export some solar equipment to Cuba. And they have beautiful sun, beautiful country, plus they have beautiful old American-made cars there.
A sample of reactions from everyday New Yorkers to the news that U.S. President Barack Obama and Cuba President Raul Castro will normalize diplomatic relations between their two nations. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
And this weekend on Press Conference USA, we will be meeting the Washington director of the Human Rights Watch organization, who will be talking about how to combat the reign of terror being inflicted by the so-called Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. Well, that's our program for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming your way at the top of the hour. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our studio engineer is Jim Harmon, and I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington. Now, just for a bit of fun, we're going to finish the program with a little holiday music from one of my favorites, renowned actress and vocalist Pearl Bailey, whose career spanned six decades beginning in the 1930s. Here she's singing the fun song, 5-Pound Box of Money.
This year, listen to me, honey. Give Pearl something that'll be of some use to me, like a 5-pound box of money. Now there's a little gift. It's loaded with lots of sentiment. See, whenever I get blue, Santa, I'm gonna think of you. But at the same time, that'll change to pay my rent, you see? Now, money isn't everything. There's no two ways about it. But while we're here, Santa dear, it's much better with than without it. So, really, I could be real good and not do nothing funny. If you do like I ask you, start me right on Christmas night. Try me, try me. Try me on that money. Just try me, honey. Santa, can you hear me? You listen to everything I'm asking about? But listen, honey, Santa dear, the new year, oh, it would be so bright and sunny. Just bring me that little simple thing I've been speaking to you about. Like that, maybe a 5-pound box of money. That's all, that's all. It would be so heavenly and help me meet both ends. Yes, indeed. What old Pearl really needs is that 5-pound box of tin. How much can it weigh? I ask you, how much? I don't want the whole money tree. What good is that big thing to me? You keep the branches. You can keep the trunk and the root. Because all that I want is just a little bit of the fruit. So if you want to be sure, I'll be your little old honey, honey bunny. You try me, start me off on Christmas night with a 5-pound. No, I better increase that. Make it 10 pounds. No, I better put in a good bag while I'm big. begging, because, I mean, I'll catch you next year. You know, people go out, and sometimes you don't see them no more, so bring the money. Santa, can you hear me? Five, bring me some money, old Santa.
This is Today in History. On December 19, 1777, during the American Revolutionary War, General George Washington led an army of about 11,000 men to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, to camp there for the winter. The conditions were severe and disease took hundreds of lives, but as the winter passed, the Continental Army regrouped, and at the direction of Baron von Steuben, a former Prussian general, the Americans emerged a more proficient fighting force. On this day in 1871, American author Samuel Clemens received a patent for a strap attached to the back of shirts and fastened with buttons to keep clothing in place. It was one of three patents the author received. Under the pen name Mark Twain, Clemens wrote two famous American novels, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. In 1907, 239 miners were killed in a coal mine explosion at Jacobs Creek, a town in western Pennsylvania. In 1932, the BBC World Service began broadcasting as the BBC Empire Service. In 1941, on this date, German dictator Adolf Hitler became the Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the German Army. In 1946, forces of Vietnam's communist leader Ho Chi Minh attacked French colonial forces in Hanoi. That attack is seen as the opening salvo of a war in which the French would lose their Southeast Asia territory. On this day in 1967, Australian Prime Minister John Holt was presumed dead after disappearing 2 days earlier while swimming at sea. In 1998, President Bill Clinton became only the second president in U.S. history to be impeached, formally accused of unlawful activity, by the House of Representatives. The Senate later found him not guilty of charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When activists at the joint mobile group Human Rights Group in Chechnya's capital of Grozny saw a number of men attempting to break into their offices on December 13th, they evacuated the premises. Soon after, the offices were on fire. Later, it was discovered that all equipment had been smashed. On the following day, Chechen police entered a joint mobile group-owned apartment without a warrant, ransacked the premises, and confiscated electronic equipment. They body-searched two lawyers who were on the premises at the time and detained them without charges for several hours. Joint Mobile Group is part of a program developed by the Russian non-governmental organization Committee Against Torture. Its purpose is to investigate human rights abuses under Russian-backed Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov. Some 50 lawyers rotate in short shifts throughout this region of Russia, where too many human rights activists and journalists investigating human rights abuses have disappeared or been killed. Both Committee Against Torture and Joint Mobile Group are headed by human rights activists and member of the Kremlin's Human Rights Council, Igor Kalyapin. This most recent attack against human rights advocates has its beginnings in a December 4th attack by insurgents against law enforcement officials in Grozny. 14 law enforcement officers and all insurgents were killed that day. In response, Ramzan Kadyrov announced that the families of the militants would be exiled and their homes destroyed. After several houses and surrounding villages burned down, Igor Kalyapin appealed to Russia's prosecutor general to investigate whether Kadyrov's orders for collective punishment of the insurgents' families might constitute a criminal offense under Article 286 of the Russian Criminal Code. Since then, Mr. Kalyapin has suffered severe harassment. He was pelted with eggs and verbally abused during a press conference and received numerous threatening phone calls and text messages. The United States is extremely concerned by reports of arson at the Grozny offices of the Joint Mobile Group and the threats directed against human rights defenders, including Igor Kalyapin, said State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. We urge the authorities to investigate this incident and the threats against these individuals and ensure the safety of all human rights defenders in Chechnya and across Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.